And it's nearly 9 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, Marlena's Electronic Salon.
Yes, it's a good day for singing a song, and it's a good day for moving along. Yes, it's a good day. How could anything be wrong? A good day from morning to night. And it's a good day for shining your shoes, and it's a good day for losing the blues. Everything to gain and nothing to lose. A good day from morning till night. I said to the sun, good morning, sun. Rise and shine today. You know you gotta get going if you gotta make a showing. A good day for curing your ills. So take a deep breath and throw away the pills, 'cause it's a good day from morning till
It's a good day, and I thought we needed a little reminder that, you know, it's a good day, because we've had a lot of rain, and some people really get bummed out behind that soggy gray thing. There are a lot of breaks, of course, in the sky, but if you're not able to take advantage of them, why then it just seems like it's always gloomy. The important thing this time of year, of course, is to get out there at midday, whether you see the sun or not. That's the peak time of light coming into this area, and you want to get some of that into your pineal gland and through your eyes, and it gets into your hormonal system, and it's important for mood regulation. So get outdoors, be around open sky for 10, 15, 20 minutes every day if you can do that, and that's going to go a long way toward keeping your mood stable. I'm Marlena Smith. It's the Electronic Salon. You're tuned to KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 on your FM band. This is the Electronic Salon. We're coming up on a full moon tomorrow, and today we have a real interesting show lined up. I have Dr. Stephen Bailey, a naturopathic physician who converses with you, the listeners, and also answers your questions. And today he's brought a dentist who will be talking about holistic dental care. So we'll have oral conversation today. Then after that, we're going to have Norma Gentile, who works with Hildegard von Bingen's music. She chants and does healing, and she will be here later this month. And then after that, we're going to have some more of the conclusion pieces of Michael Moore, the mythologist, on initiation and the soul. Before we go to Stephen, we're going to just get a quick update from the mountain astrologer on the full moon tomorrow in Cancer at 24 degrees Cancer Capricorn. Once more, the sun and moon align on opposite sides of the earth, polarizing and expanding awareness. In Jungian and alchemical terms, the full moon symbolizes the sacred marriage, the confluence of masculine and feminine, leading to unity of consciousness. Of the signs in the zodiac, the two most descriptive of the masculine-feminine balance are Capricorn and Cancer. Technically, both are yin, or receptive and inclusive energies, but in modern times, Capricorn has become more associated with a yang, patriarchal mode and the drive for personal gain, rather than a sense of service to the collective. As the 10th sign in an archetypal cycle of 12, Capricorn is the phase of becoming fully accountable for one's actions and fulfilling one's role in society. Wherever the sun is 24 degrees in your chart is the area in which you're ready to claim more authority and responsibility in your life. Cancer is the sign most associated with the yin, or feminine principle, and the importance of home and family. The fourth sign and fourth house can be seen as the roots of a tree. Without a nourishing base, we cannot grow as tall nor bear as much fruit. Our contribution to the world is limited by our past conditioning and unhealthy environments. The house where the moon at 24 degrees Cancer falls in your chart is where you could receive more support and be instrumental in supporting others. The moon also spotlights where we might be out of balance in our personal and professional lives and where we can come back into alignment by paying more attention to intuition. Venus is conjunct the sun, her energy greatly concentrated and amplified by the sun's rays. The mythic goddess of love and beauty retrogrades in Capricorn, asking us to review our goals and our relationship to authority. There is a bumper sticker that says, "He who dies with the most toys still dies." What is success, and what are we willing to do for it? Venus in Capricorn strives for recognition and achievement as she moves retrograde. We become aware of whether we've been living by our own values or someone else's. Venus retrograde in Capricorn also calls us to review and restructure governments, corporations, and institutions that are not serving the greater good, a theme that continues until the next turn, which is another retrograde at the end of July of this year, or of next year. Venus's mythic counterpart, Mars, also plays a starring role in this full moon because Mars's recent retrograde phase, Mars has been at the center for some time, redirecting passion and rewriting the bottom line. Mars has been involved in an extended grand cross and fixed sign whose forces peak during this full moon. Mars is 15 degrees Taurus, tightly opposing Jupiter at 15 Scorpio, while squaring both Neptune at 16 Aquarius and Saturn at 9 Leo. The middle degrees of a sign represent the most concentrated expression of that energy as well as the pivotal point of change. The outer planets, Jupiter through Pluto, are much further from the sun and represent a more expanded level of consciousness. In the experience of the writer of Mountain Astrologer, when an inner planet, the sun, moon, Mercury, Venus, or Mars, is aspected by an outer planet, the outer planet always wins. In this case, Neptune, having to do with unity, having more perspective, extends our understanding and expression of Mars, which has a lot to do with personal desire. Jupiter has a lot to do with faith, and Saturn with authority. So those are the issues that are in tight, challenging relationship. Unity, personal desire, faith, and authority. Uranus at 8 degrees of Pisces semi-squares the Sun and Venus and quincunxes Saturn, further aiding the breakdown of old patterns and limited perception. Uranus says it can't be business as usual, it's time to get back to the heart. The Sabian symbols echo the need to put love in the driver's seat. For the Sun at 25 degrees Capricorn, a store filled with precious oriental rugs, the use of cultural and artistic processes as a means to enhance personal comfort and appreciation. And for the moon at 25 Cancer in this full moon complex, a willful man is overshadowed by a descent of superior power, the response of spiritual forces to the integration of the personality through positive will, willful endeavors. This full moon reveals then that power is of two kinds. One is obtained by the fear of punishment and the other by acts of love from Gandhi. Reading that from the Mountain Astrologer. Okay, well, now we're going to go to Dr. Bailey, and I want to remind you that this is an information segment. It is not meant for diagnostic or treatment purposes. You are advised to see your own providers for those kinds of things. This is just to give you information to aid you in your care provision by your private medical provider. Stephen?
Good morning, and good morning to everybody out there in KBOO land. My guest today is Dr. Inna Szymanowski, who is a doctor here in Oak Grove, which is out McLaughlin Boulevard, and she is a bonding dentist, and we'll be talking about the difference between mercury dentists and bonding dentists. We'll be talking some about mercury. We'll be talking about dental trainings and protocols, and in the second half of the show, we will open up for callers. Before I get started with the doctor, I just wanted to give a couple points out there, one of which is A few months ago, we did a show on the bird flu where we had a doctor from OHSU, I think head of virology or infectious disease, call in, and we talked at some great detail, and I'd made the point, and he agreed, that probably the mortality of bird flu was due to the fact that not everybody who had it would be showing up to get treatment in these countries. And this week, in Archives of Medicine, a Swedish team did a study where they went to Vietnam and found in villages up to 3,000 people who reported flu-like symptoms. They will be doing titers to see if they did have the bird flu that we are so fearful of. But if they did in fact have this flu, then we are looking at, unless if in its mutation to human contact it changes its morbidity or the severity of the infection, that we're probably looking at a level of mortality that is more consistent with flus that have not been the great epidemics, like the Spanish flu, which was of this variety back in the 1917s and 1918s. But it appears from this fortunate, optimistic, if you might say, for we, the people who don't know the future, study, that it's probably not in the 30% fatality, 50% fatality, or even maybe even the 10% fatality. We may be looking at a much lower level of virulence, because when you're talking about villages particularly, and there's the discussion about the new strains being found in Turkey, that these birds are pets and often the people will hide them, and the Turkish spokesman on this show I was listening to said we need to convince people that their children are more important than their birds. In these third world countries that don't have the Turkish stock exchange bell going on every day and the affluence that we have here, the birds are also part of their children's welfare. They provide eggs, they provide food, they are part of the sustenance. We have to remember that when we condemn people for not responding to the government being willing to kill their birds, that they look at this as how they get food into their children's bellies. And so it is not just a matter of ignorance and a failure to have good public policy, but it's an aspect of society and some of the social imbalances that exist. Second comment I'm going to make as we go into our discussion about dentistry is I met an old trucker friend of mine who we were talking about juices this morning, and we came across talking about Wyoming. And I remember back in 1979, driving across country in my Volkswagen bus, I saw two people shivering under an overpass hitchhiking, and I stopped and picked them up. And they were oil field workers. They'd been working in Texas. They told me that they'd done, a man and his woman partner, or a woman and her male partner, told me that they get rotated, that they only spend 6 months at any refining plant. And that, in fact, allows them to not have long-standing toxic exposure science to people, and certainly not single plant oriented levels of poor environmental standards. So as we talk about mercury today, realize that the discussion of mercury goes from the far extreme of thinking that it is absolutely safe to inject first ethyl, then methyl, then methylated mercury aluminum into children's bodies for immunizations. We have people who say there are no problems with that, and we have people that say that they are the cause of a great number of diseases. And we talked about this last spring on our show. We have a lot of grayness in between, and with all of the multiplicities of toxins and synthetic unnatural exposures to our bodies, it is very hard to scientifically point with no statistical room for error to a single agent's impact at a societal status. So as we talk about dentistry, I'd like you to listen to what Dr. Szymanowski has to say about what she was trained, about what the doctor that preceded her and the doctor that she studied with here in Portland in his clinic, as well as her medical training, tells us about the care within the dental industry to recognize that mercury is a hazardous chemical when it comes out of the mouth. And we can open up later to discuss of how hazardous it is in the mouth. But welcome to KBOO, Doctor.
Hi, I'm Dr. Shumanowski. Good morning.
And you practice at Advanced Dental out in Oak Grove.
Right. We have a mercury-free practice on McLaughlin Boulevard.
And Dr. Hepler was a doctor that was doing that for almost 15 or 20 years.
Yeah, he was in that location for 15 years, and he maintained the mercury practice for all that period of time.
And was it a dental office before he was there?
It was. It was probably for another 10 years prior to that.
Okay. So there was probably some effort on his part to get some of the mercury out of the building before he brought the patients in. I have a dentist friend out in Gresham who is working in the system to do less mercury, but also wondering about what his exposure to mercury is. You drill out mercury sometimes in people's mouths. What do you do to protect yourself in this circumstance?
Well, first of all, we use the purifier and ionizer in the office. That's our big thing. We don't have carpet in the operatories that would absorb mercury. We use a special suction that protects patients as well as ourselves to protect it from, you know, vaporization of the mercury. And we take charcoal just as well as our patients do during the removal of the mercury.
Tell our listeners what the difference is between a bonding dentist and what we would consider the 80% of dentists out there in America that still use the amalgams.
Well, the difference is amalgam is the, that's what I was trained on, is basically doing amalgam. That's a conservative dentistry. That's what everybody gets trained in dental schools, even though it's been changed in the last 5 years or so. But the difference between that is using completely different materials to restore people's mouth. Amalgam, as we know it today, is by far inferior material to what is available out there. And the alternative to amalgam is definitely is bonded restorations, that is composites, which are resin-based materials, porcelain, and ceramics.
One of the things that parents bring up or other people bring up as I talk about this to them is that the 80% of dentists are real quick to tell you that an amalgam is much more durable and that a composite is not nearly as stable in the mouth.
Well, the thing with that is, I think, that because the composites are extremely, or bonded restorations are extremely technique sensitive, it is a lot easier to just put amalgam in there and say, okay, it's going to last. And it's as a metal, it won't crack as easy. That's what people think. However, amalgams, we've seen them last for 30 to 40 years, but we also have seen the damage that it does to the mouth and to the body. We've seen amalgams 5 years after placement having decay underneath. We've seen amalgams placing cracks in the teeth a few years after it was placed due to having mercury in it. And I would not say at all that it is a better restoration that would last longer.
If I'm not mistaken, we used to use mercuries in thermometers because with heat, mercury expands much more than any other metal. The other metals in the amalgam composition, and certainly teeth don't expand that much with heat.
Absolutely.
Because if we drank a hot cup of coffee and our teeth swelled up, we'd have all sorts of problems. Is that, do you think, why you get so much cracking and then in... My wife volunteered for the geriatric dental program for a number of years, and I've talked with an ombudsman, and as we have more and more elderly people living in care facilities or living at home, they become less efficacious in their dental hygiene, mm-hmm. and dental infections are a significant cause of heart disease and illness and shortened
right.
life and poor quality in elderly.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think it's that cracking phenomenon? Do you think this is associated with it? And where would you lead for people? Because a lot of people say, gee, they're in already. Maybe I won't get them in the future. Should people actually consider removing mercury from their mouth?
Well, definitely, from what I've seen in my practice, if the amalgam has been in the mouth 8 to 10 years, there is a definite need to remove it. For the most part, when we take amalgams out, 85% to 90% of the time, there is some decay underneath that is just hard to detect on the x-rays. and certainly cracks. And like just like you pointed out, because of the mercury in that, it definitely expands and contracts, not at the same rate as the tooth does. When we deal with composite or porcelain restorations, they also expand and contract. However, they do that at the same rate as the tooth does, and therefore they are biocompatible.
I will make the disclaimer that you are one of the two dentists that I have gone to in the past couple years, and that's part of why I brought you on the show, because I think you've got some excellent training and information.
Thank you.
My other dentist, as I knew Dr. Hepler and your work, I started talking to his technicians about their secondhand radiation exposure and how much radiation was used, and lo and behold, their office got a computer digital X-ray that reduces the radiation by probably
20%. It's 90% reduction.
Yeah, so you're down to 10% of the original exposure, and I think for me, I've never thought that shooting through a tooth and metal in an infant with a brainstem right behind it was necessarily a good idea, particularly if you've got dental insurance and you do this on a regular basis. Do the digitals have any increase? And this is one of the things, I went to an excellent talk by a dentist last spring that was from Texas, and he talked about what you were saying, that there was a woman who was, she was actually an she'd gone down to Mexico and got crowns put on, and she was neurologically just going downhill, and ironically, an energy tester was just absolutely certain that one tooth was infected. He did three X-rays, couldn't see any infection. Told me that according to ADA, if you can't clinically or radiographically or cosmetically justify removing a crown, you can't remove it as a dentist under the AMA standards. But he, with about a half an inch of disclaimers and release forms, agreed, pulled the crown off, and showed the picture of it, just one of the ugliest decays that was leaching into the mouth. And as soon as he pulled this root out, this woman who hadn't been able to sleep, who was having hyperactivity in his nerves, just melted in the chair, and for the first time in almost 2 years was able to relax, had to call family to drive her home because she was so exhausted. What is the aspect, is there any difference in diagnosis, and how, when you get a crown, are you able to know whether you've got an infection underneath?
Well, basically, it is a hard question, and sometimes what we do is, the reason we get the crown in the first place is probably due to destruction of the tooth and destruction of the crown due to decay. So we just go after decay, we remove all of the decay, and we use special solution that's called caries detector that would tell us if there is any more decay left on the tooth structure. Now, whether or not nerve has gotten affected or not, we can only go by symptoms at that point. If patients presents with, and we do the certain testing, and it looks like it's a reversible situation, at that point we stop and we temporize the tooth. And it takes about 2 to 3 weeks for the crown to be made. That 2 to 3 weeks period of time is also acting as a testing period where we keep in touch with the patient and just go by how it feels. Usually if you've got infectious process that's starting up or irreversible process, it will just probably go downhill in that 2-3 week period because we have disturbed the tooth. And if there time comes to seat the crown and the patients are asymptomatic or just have minor symptoms, we just go ahead and put the crown on and, you know, leave it at that. We'll always monitor the teeth, especially crown teeth, because it is a danger of turning south. But that's basically what it is. We have to rely on patients. Beyond what we do and clean the tooth and get rid of all the bacteria that decay the tooth at that time, we just rely on their symptoms and their reports.
As I was talking about my dentist making changes, he was always willing to put composites in. I haven't had anybody put mercury in my mouth for probably 25 or more years, although I haven't had dental insurance for over 30 years, and I haven't removed all of my fillings. I'm doing the slow. Outside of paying for what my family needs, my highest discretionary budget goes towards building up dental work, and I was told by an excellent doctor that the dental infection is the only type of infection that the human body can't heal on its own, and that it is so entrapped, whereas you take something like gonorrhea, one out of three people, according to conventional medicine, won't even let it in, and one out of three will cure it without any problems.
Mm-hmm.
We have virtually no infections that some people don't cure on their own, but dental infections are different. But as my dentist has been good, I was pleased when I went in the last time that he put a rubber dam in my mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And I've learned and heard of how mercury, which is a environmentally EPA-controlled substance before you get it with special guidelines and manufacturer warnings that say things like it should not be given, never put in an expectant mother, never in children six and under, never been used for material for a cast crown, never be used with patients with kidney or heart disease. And
that's a big disclaimer.
It is a disclaimer, but yet I've seen a lot of children that have mercury in their mouths at an earlier stage than six. So the general aspect is before it goes in the mouth, it's toxic and to be handled with care. And after it comes out of the mouth, it's toxic and a hazardous waste. And when in King County, it was a voluntary dental support to keep the mercury out of the rivers with a lot of education. 4 or 5% of the dentists took the extra effort to take this toxic metal and not just flush it down the toilet.
Right.
Then it became law. We're seeing laws change in a lot of states. But tell me how, to your knowledge, the best case amalgam removal would take place. What would you do for the patient, and what should they ask or look for in their dentist?
Well, I tell you what we do in our office. The patients present. First of all, a lot of the patients do come as a referral to from naturopath doctors due to their high mercury toxicity level in the body. Those patients who are sick, we offer them oxygen masks. Some patients decline that, then we put masks that we use, dental masks, on their noses to prevent the splatter and inhalation. We use large goggles that basically shields the whole face. we offer, before we start the procedure, charcoal acts as an absorbent to whatever vapors or whatever particles may escape during the procedure. We have a special suction, and I know you mentioned the rubber dam, and we had the discussion earlier. Rubber dam is a very elementary thing that we all were trained during dental school. The rubber dam isolates the teeth we're working on, and it shields all the debris from the rest of your oral cavity. So that would be a step one to take. We, in our office, using a different suction tip that's called cleanup suction. It was developed in Europe in probably 2 or 3 years ago. It started used in United States. And what it does, it basically shields that particular tooth that we're going to be removing amalgam from. And it's connected to the high-speed suction. So whatever we drill out, all the debris just gets sucked up in that suction. Extremely minimizing. There have been studies comparing that to rubber dam, and they've seen a 90% reduction in mercury particles or mercury vapors that are just getting elicited out there in the room. Besides that, we don't have any carpet in a room. Operatories shouldn't have any carpet just for that particular purpose. Nothing gets absorbed in the carpet. Let's see, what else do we use? We have ionizers in the purifier in the office, like I said. And that's pretty much basic amalgam removal protocol that any dentist who is removing amalgam should be using. We have the amalgam that we remove has a separate mercury trap that gets disposed by a special company who comes in and disposes it. So I would say that's should be a standard of care for the amalgam removal.
You're listening to KBOO, Marlena Smith's show, Electric Salon. I'm Dr. Stephen Bailey, and my guest is Dr. Inna Szymanowski, who is at Advanced Dental in Oak Grove, which is between Oregon City and, no, between Milwaukee and Oregon City. And her clinic's number is 503-659-3003. That's 503-659-3003. In a few minutes, I'll be offering to let people call in and ask questions, but I want to go through a couple more things about Amalgam. Are you a member of the ADA?
Yes, I am.
Okay. So I will take a point of giving this discussion because one of the things that the ADA requires of their members is that they not speak too harshly against mercury. Are you familiar with the change in the composite of amalgams that took place in the 70s?
Right.
So for our listeners, just to remind you, in the 70s, 74, the Hunt brothers started making a run on silver. The price of silver quadrupled. In spite of an ADA document in the 50s that said never change the formulation of the amalgam, the standard in 1976 went from 3% copper, 30% silver, to 3% silver, 30% copper. And what this creates, and if you look under a high-power microscope, mercury never binds with the other metals. Mm-hmm. It sits as free liquids that then can be vaporized, and it's an impactment, just like putting sand in a hole that the amalgams use. But they create an electronic charge, and through mercury halide lights and other things, we found that the outgassing of the mercury since 1976 is up to 50 times as fast as it was in people who got fillings back in the 50s, 40s, and 30s. The term quack comes from the German doctors that started using mercury, quacksilver, putting them into teeth back in the early 1800s. And these doctors, when mercury doctors came to America, other dental societies wouldn't allow them to belong. And so the ADA created itself as a professional branch to umbrella these doctors. Mm-hmm. And hence, the ADA has a pretty strong necessity to say that mercury is safe in the human mouth. And my old U.S. dispensatories say we can take mercury of chloride orally for constipation and it's not absorbed. And we know that to be different. I have a study in front of me where they put radioactive labeled mercury into monkeys and 1 month later found that the mercury from those fillings was deposited in the thymus, the thyroid, the kidneys, the liver, the small intestine. Mm-hmm. It does leach out. We've got similar sheep studies. So there's a great degree of scientific evidence that doesn't make a thinking person be able to be quite as acquiescent as the ADA in the risks of what's going on. As I've said that now, this doctor from Texas told me that every dentist in medical school is going to be taught to drill out a filling in a straight column and to use a rubber dam. Mm-hmm. And that the vast majority, as soon as they get out of dental school, throw away the rubber dams and start drilling out with a wider bottom so the mercury can be packed. It's shaken up like a little paint shaker. Mm-hmm. You pack it down, and it doesn't bind to the tooth. It's just packed in with a density. Mm-hmm. And so it does have a much greater ability to let things. Fortunately, I guess mercury is so toxic to microbes that the space that always exists between the filling and the inside of the tooth that isn't protected with enamel has some degree of sterilization, but yet still we get some degrees of decay going on in it. Do you agree with that point that dentists change the way they drill out teeth because drilling out wide at the bottom weakens the strength of the tooth in the long term? And do you think that if a typical patient somehow convince their doctor through cosmetics that they needed a rubber dam, that virtually every dentist out there could start using the rubber dams today?
Well, as far as drilling out the tooth, I'm not sure how the doctor was taught that you're saying that he was taught to drill out in the tube. We were actually taught to drill out wider in the bottom for the purpose of retention. Amalgam just won't stay otherwise, like you mentioned, because there is no chemical bonding. It's just a matter of mechanical impaction of the filling into the tooth. And we were taught to drill out wider in the bottom. there is no question about it that it does weaken the tooth. It undermines the cusps, and as amalgam starts spinning in contraction, that's where the cusp starts fracturing because of that. As far as the rubber dam, are you saying that you're suggesting that dentists should be using rubber dam?
I'm saying that until I came to see you or a couple dentists recently, I'd never seen a rubber dam in my mouth.
Right. It's I guess it's a matter of convenience for people, although I personally, I think it's a great tool. It helps me as well as it helps the patient to just keep all the debris out of the mouth. It keeps just keeps them cleaner in the mouth. So I personally like, although you're right, a lot of people just quit using it, thinking that they have an assistant so they have enough suction and control in the mouth, and they really should.
A very well-respected dentist followed this doctor around and said, I love what you do, but it takes too much time. I would never be able to, and he does the same thing with the suction, the additional water, the oxygen, the rubber dam. Is it convenience for the patient or convenience for the dentist, or do you not care to make
it? I think putting the rubber dam is a convenience for both.
Yeah.
It really doesn't take very long time to put a rubber dam, but once the rubber dam is on, I think it makes everything a lot faster.
So if nothing else, rubbers are important. That's a discussion that KBU has talked about in the past, but not quite at this level. As I remember, you were born in the USSR in Ukraine and grew up in Russia.
Correct.
And you've moved here. A lot of our advances in biosympathetic dentistry come from Europe.
Mm-hmm.
What does the Russian dental industry do? Do they do primarily amalgam, and what is Europe doing?
Well, I left when I was 18 years old, and I wasn't too aware of what's going on in the dental world back then. But I do know that I got fillings in my mouth back in probably 87, 88, and they were not amalgam at that point. As a child, I had a couple fillings done. They were amalgam, and ever since I went to a dentist in 87, 88. They were already switched to composites at that time. So now it makes me realize that probably even there at that point, they knew that amalgam is not a restoration of choice.
We'll have time to take some calls from you at 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. And normally I open up the broad waves for any question that people have, regardless of the topic. But I would like to honor our guest and stay within the topic of dentistry and amalgams and this particular topic, and darned if dentistry isn't strongly related to holistic naturopathic medicine, because if you've got infection or poisons in your teeth, it is hard to keep the immune system, the neurologic system, the cardiovascular system, the renal system in good shape, maybe the glandular system as well. So For those of you folks who think sometimes it's not a naturopathic show, and as if that really mattered, I do see this as being critical in service to my patients. Do we have a caller there, Marlena? Let's go ahead and take the first caller.
Yeah, hello. I'm on the Oregon Health Plan for dental care, and because I need crowns, but I can't afford the real ones, so they put these stainless steel ones, and about three of my teeth, after doing this through the years, the tooth finally becomes infected in the gum and that. And they say the only things to, if I hadn't had it replaced with another one, they say the only thing to do is to extract. So I've had three teeth because I don't know where to go. I don't want my teeth taken out. And not only the infection, I have all different kinds of pain, in my neck and that. And head, and I was just wondering, do you have any help for people like us? I guess there isn't, unless you have money, if we're going to have to get these stainless steel crowns. And maybe not everybody has that problem with these stainless steel crowns because you can't afford the regular ones. Also, I want to ask one more thing. If you can't have the mercury taken out of your mouth, is there some herbs or something you can help your body to protect it from it?
I'll answer the second question, and I'll let our good doctor talk about the stainless. And one of the unfortunate aspects, a lot of people say that dentistry is expensive, and it is expensive as compared to a lot of things that are not essential. But one of the things I've learned is that good dentistry costs a tremendous amount of equipment, overhead, and protective costs. And I don't see that the dentists are earning an inappropriate amount of money. It just costs money to do the type of good work that is out there. So I love it when a patient puts family health care above, and I understand that our listener doesn't have a big DVD and widescreen television. I understand that she's not having this discretionary money, but I really think that that prevention and care of our physical bodies is one of the very important things to budget in if we have any money. What about stainless and what about low-income options to the cheapest dentistry?
As far as stainless steel crown, and I don't know whether they mentioned that to you or not when they placed those crowns, that they are temporary crowns, and therefore they create all the problems that you are having. They're preformed crowns, so when they place them on your tooth, obviously there is no adaptation to the tooth, and it irritates your gum. It lets the bacteria underneath the crown. So, I mean, that explains why you're having those problems. Oral hygiene is extremely important if you do have those crowns. Have them maybe go to another dentist and double-check those crowns. They need to be placed in extreme care, adapted to the tooth as well as possible so it doesn't irritate your gums. So if you don't feel like maybe they've placed properly, try to get another dentist opinion and maybe they get readjusted. Another option that is possible for temporary crowns are acrylic crowns, realizing they're not as durable as stainless steel crowns. However, they could be made to be adapted to your tooth much better than stainless steel crowns.
Thanks.
Does that kind of answer your question?
She dropped off the air. So I just wanted to say I carry a quantum dental detoxifier that's a combination of absorbent materials, peats and volcanic ash with antifungal herbs, immune support herbs, and it's just a rinse that will pull stuff out of your mouth, gums, and cheeks and spit it out. And this type of product, it's not widespread. I haven't seen it at a retail level, and I'm not here to market this, but there are a few specialty companies that can help you to get the mercury out versus swallowing it down and letting it distribute and have its powerful influence on your body. We've got a number of people on the calls, but one last thing. What about what they put under the crowns, and is there a difference between various substances that pack the crown onto the tooth?
Well, they used to use almost always as a buildup or amalgam, just because they thought it would be a good support for the crown. We don't use that, and I don't use that in my practice. I use composite type of a material that is a buildup material under the crown, and it's also bonded.
And isn't there something called Pergo or something that that was used for root canals?
Oh, gutta percha, you mean?
Yeah, gutta percha. Some of the products that I use don't have the mercury, but they have cadmium and lead, and Dr. Hepler was informing me about this. So there are dentists like yourself who really reach out into the literature and the professionals that can help tutor you to find the best biosympathetic materials that can be used. Let's take another caller. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I have a question. First, I want to go back to what you were saying about the rinse that you used, and I wanted to know what is it and where do you find it? And then I also wanted to know whether the doctor has any knowledge of anybody who might be a bonding dentist who works with Oregon Health Plan. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Well, the rinse that I found, an old doctor friend of mine, my main teacher these days, who studied with Benedict Lust and was actually Edgar Casey's doctor back in the 40s, told my wife to send me to this workshop. And she didn't even call me to see if she needed my approval. She knew that when this doctor tells me to do something, I am out the door and doing it. And so I paid to get certified in a type of energy diagnosis so that I could get these detox products from this company. And so there are a number of people in Portland that work with this company. It's out of Texas. You may find massage therapists and acupuncturists. The training and products are used only for licensed healthcare practitioners. We had a PhD physicist who couldn't get in because he wasn't a healthcare provider. It's called Quantum Dental Detoxifier. It's reasonably priced for this type of thing. I have it at my office, and I'm at Northwest Naturopathic Clinic, and I'm really not trying to promote me or my clinic for these types of purposes. I think it was 6 or 7 years of doing KBOO before people even knew I had an office in Portland. But this is one product that I have, and I saw the doctor about to answer, who is a bonding dentist in the Oregon Health Plan?
You know, I actually do not know anybody personally, just because people who are participating in Oregon Health Plan realizing that it's not a covered benefit. So, yeah, unfortunately, I don't know anybody in Portland metro area who accepts Oregon Health Plan and who's bonding dentist.
We've got another caller. Let's go
Wait,
on the
I
air.
Have
Hi.
To try your call again.
Oh, we lost those folks. Let's see if there's somebody on the next line. Hello?
Zero.
Two.
Hello?
Are you on the air? Hi.
Yeah, hi.
You have a question for...
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay. I'll turn my radio down.
Again, my guest is Dr. Shibanovsky, who has an office down on McLaughlin, southeast of Portland, between Milwaukee and Oregon City. Are you back to the phone now? We've got a slow... Yeah, okay. Did you have a question for our guest?
I'm getting a porcelain crown installed in my mouth Monday, and I'm a little concerned now. A Louisiana state student, dental student, is going to put it in. I'm in New Orleans. And so I'm wondering, the composite materials that are used, is a light used to install that material or to harden it?
You mean the bonding, as a bonding compound? Or whatsoever underneath your crown? I'm not sure.
Well, I'm trying to figure out if...
How they're going to bond it?
If they're using amalgam or not. Because I didn't ask, and so I'm trying to figure out how I can tell what I have underneath my temporary right now.
Okay. First of all, you can ask the doctor what's as a buildup in my tooth. Secondly, once they remove the temporary, you can ask for the mirror and look at your tooth. If your tooth looks dark and silver, that's amalgam. If it looks white or tooth color, that's composite.
Amalgam, it looked all silver, and it was a big bunch of a wad of gum.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. If it's dark and metal-looking, it's amalgam.
You can always turn around and walk out the door if you can't convince your dentist to use the products that you want. And when it comes to your long-term health, hurting somebody's feeling is not something that you should take heavily. You should just say, this is what I need. I want to not have mercury put back into my mouth, if that's your choice. And if they can't do it, I don't know where you would rub the few dollars together to find somebody that can. But I think that it's essential that you don't be a massive sheep when you go into a doctor or a dentist's office. You have to understand what they're suggesting, be given a role in the decision making,
mm-hmm.
and decide what is best for you.
Absolutely. Ultimately, it is your health and it is your choice. So you can tell the doctor what you want and what what you'd like to be put in your mouth.
We have some more calls. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, I was listening to NPR recently, and they had a dentist that was talking about the commercial use of probiotics to promote better oral health and how this reduced periodontal disease, and I was wondering, is there can you recommend, is there any commercial products available like this?
The most common organism in the mouth is Lactobacillus salivarius, I believe, and you could look for that specific species, salivarius, at some of the health food stores. There are a lot of probiotics. Probiotics can be one or two friendly bacterium. The ones I use in my office generally include at least eight, because we aren't a forest of just one type of trees. We've got a wide array of microbes that live within our mouth and our oral canal all the way down to the rectum. 10 to 100 trillion friendly bacterium are supposed to be occupying there. So, yeah, you want to rinse and clean out your mouth. You want to instill good dental health, but I would say that at this point, find a capsule or probiotic or a powder and use it as a rinse, and I would think that would be very helpful. Comments, Doctor?
Oh, I agree. Yeah, whatever can help the live bacteria in your mouth, it would be helpful for the patient for their oral health.
Good question. We've got another caller on the air. Hi, you're on KBU.
Good morning, and thanks for the great conversation.
Thank you.
I'm wondering what the doctor's general advice would be for adults who have had many amalgam fillings in their mouth for, 30 years or more.
Okay, well, like I said earlier, in majority of cases, if the amalgams have been placed, especially the larger amalgams, over 10, 15 years, there's a definite need to remove them. And so what I would suggest is basically get the exam done by a doctor who looks at the amalgam in a different way, like I do, and have them take a special attention to whether teeth are not cracked, whether there is a corrosion to the metal, because if those things present in the mouth, then fillings definitely should get replaced.
And one of the things that I would say, I would never recommend that a pregnant woman have mercury removed from her mouth. Mm-hmm. It is a time to find a rinse or do whatever you can, but don't do this process. Even the best techniques, and if they're done without the lakes and the extra care, it's even more harsh on your system. Do it in a graduated base. One or two amalgams being replaced, and wait at least a month before you do the next one. Give your immune system and your body a time chance to strengthen itself to deal with the next insult, because while we like to think that teeth are more like stones, they are living part organs and part of our body. Mm-hmm. And they take insult and they communicate, and we don't want to go from being a couch potato to entering the marathon. We want to start with a half mile, maybe a mile, do some walking, build ourselves up to it. We don't want to go in and get every amalgam removed in a short period of time. Take your time. Pace yourself. Next caller. Hi, you're on KBU.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yep.
I've been getting the amalgam fillings removed from my mouth over time, and I've been trying to understand how this works. And one question I've never really gotten answered is, does this outgassing happen at a steady rate, or is it happen quickly when you first get the filling installed and then decrease over time?
From my understanding is the biggest exposure to mercury you do get at the time when it's placed, because mercury is liquidy material, so until it completely hardens, you get exposed quite a bit. But throughout lifetime, it elicits mercury constantly.
Okay.
It never stops. The statistics are within 10 years, 50% of the mercury in an amalgam is going to be gone in the current mercury amalgams. But we've got photos of amalgams that have been in for 30, 40 years, stored dry in shelves for 10 years, and we can still see the shadow of the mercury outgas with a miner's mercury halide lamp. You put a light up to the mercury, you can't see it. You put a halide lamp, mercury halide that is absorbed by the mercury, and you see a plume of mercury smoke coming out of these substances. Next caller, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello. Would you like to speak up?
Oh,
you're
hello.
On the air.
Hi. Yes, two quick questions. Where can a person get reliable mercury testing with objective testing to see how it may have be affecting the body? And my second question is crown. Should the amalgam be removed first, which it sounds logical, and I do have some existing crowns, how would I know if the previous dentist, now we're going back a few years, did remove any amalgam underneath? And I will take my, I'll go off the air.
Well, I will answer your second question. As far as knowing whether the crowns have amalgams underneath, obviously the best way to know that it would be obtaining your dental records from your previous dentist. However, I would say in majority of cases that if the crowns were placed number of years ago, the build-up material under the crowns was always, oh, for the most part, I should say, 85-95% of the time was amalgam. So the chances are really high that you have amalgam under the crowns.
And they probably have some periodontal disease, so you generally see a black linear line at the bottom of the crown in a lot of mouths. Is
yeah, black line is not necessarily periodontal disease. What it's called is amalgam tattoo, because the amalgam leaches out of the tooth into your soft tissue. So if you see the dark dark lines around that tooth, that is amalgam inside your tooth.
I know of the amalgam tattoos, and that made me understand 35, 40 years ago that there was something missing in this discussion that you could tattoo tissues. But what I'm saying is if you have periodontal disease and the gums go beneath the crown, you'll see a black line of the bonding there.
Sometimes, yeah, unless the amalgam was placed on top of the tooth.
Walter Crinion is the head of our environmental medicine program down at the Southwest College of Naturopathic Medicine and is our contemporary left-brain scientific guru of environmental toxins, being on Barbara Walters and a number of shows. I've spoken with him about this, and generally mercury detection is done by doing a challenge, trying to bind the mercury in the system and measuring it in the urine. He says that in clearly mercury-toxic people, sometimes you have to run the test 5 times to find the mercury. So if it quacks like a duck, swims like a duck, has feather, you've got some mercury in your system and your body doesn't have efficient pathways to get it out, and it has a chance in uninformed consent. A video I saw, a Canadian study showed that 1 part per 10 million mercury in the bloodstream or in a petri dish can shrivel the nerve myelin sheath of cells. So it is more toxic than 100 times more potent levels of aluminum, cadmium, and lead. It is a very toxic at low level. If you've got amalgam, if you're getting immunizations, if you use any of the 2.5 million products in America, there are many paints that outgas mercury. We've got a case of a school closing down in Salem. 8 schools with the same rubberized floor. The school that was closed down had measurable mercury above EPA level standards, which is not necessarily the most conservative standards. So there is a lot of mercury out there. So there are, zinc is one of the best internal chelators to help get it out of the body, but it stores everywhere, it leaches back out, and it is not easily measurable. Therefore, this first story about Wyoming and petrochemical rotation, so that we don't have studies without detection, you have a real hard time proving that there's a singular linear cause of insult to people's health with mercury. We've got time for one last caller. Nope, we're off the air. We're coming up to the next hour of Marlena's show, The Electronic Salon. I'm Dr. Stephen Bailey. My guest, and thank you once more for sharing your knowledge with us, is Dr. Inna Shamanovsky, who is at Advanced Dental down on McLaughlin Boulevard, someone I have a very high respect for. And
thank you.
Maybe if you have further questions, her office can help you with these. But realize that just because it's silent doesn't mean it isn't there. They sometimes call things the silent killers. I don't want to make you all paranoid. You are the same person now that you were an hour ago before you listened to this show. But there are some things you can do to help prepare yourself for a healthier life, or maybe see some remarkable changes in your health as you accept it today. So thank you again, Doctor, for being with us.
Dr. Shimanowski, I also want to thank you. I know an hour of your time is pretty valuable, so I really am particularly grateful for what you've given us today.
My pleasure.
We've probably started a whole new generation of people going out there to their dentists asking harder questions, and that's the way change happens.
I give my patients a how to choose a dentist handout often when this is a concern. It's produced by another company, but they don't copyright it to me. And it is really worthwhile, whether it's an obstetrician, a naturopath, a chiropractor, an osteopath, or a dentist, to demand a relationship that gives you respect to communicate and understand what's going on. To all of you, my best. Have a great month. I'll be back in February with another show with Marlena on the second Friday.
I want to thank Stephen and Dr. Shimanovsky. You are listening to KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 on the FM band here in Portland. And we'll have a musical break, and then we'll be back with Norma Gentile.